Now, here's what I was going to say. I felt badly that I, I actually just slipped my mind, to be honest. I got back and I've been so busy, but I'm leaving again today. So I thought we'd get started.
Sure.
And if you would like more time, then no problem. And maybe we could work out when both of us are here, which would probably be good. Because one of the things you're probably going to be interested in is what we and I did together, which was that membership list by the 5250 Grant.
Absolutely.
And I think she probably, would add a lot because she has a better memory than I do. So why don't we start? Maybe we have a little less than an hour, and
okay.
Then we can set up another time.
Like yeah, you just tell me when you need to go, and that's
when you need to go.
When I need to go, right?
I'm going. You're going back to work here. I've got a million things to do before I go.
You leaving town later today?
Yeah, I have a flight here.
Okay. Well, maybe we can start. You can just tell me, Dave, a little bit about how you got to Madison and UW. I don't know if you're from Wisconsin or. Were you from New Jersey? Did I read that somewhere?
Yeah. Well, you know how Louise. Did you read the On Wisconsin story about the Ford boys?
No, I haven't read it, Judge.
Okay, well, Louise got here because she was a Ford girl. So she came here because of this Ford program.
Right.
But you need to know about it because it was part of the atmosphere of that period. And I'll give you the briefest thumbnail because it's a very good story. The Ford Foundation developed a program in the 50s. The idea was initially to have young men start college before they were likely to get drafted. And they were worried, this was the Korean War period, and that they were worried that if young men were drafted, who would have college potential, but then they might not be able to go to college. So mm-hmm. Get them early before they finished high school when they were still 16 or so, and then if they got there, they could go back. And Wisconsin was one of the four initial schools. And then soon after they started it, they decided to add women. I don't know why they added women, because it didn't fit with the original rationale. Maybe the rationale was changed. And Wisconsin was one of the largest groups, and this brought in an unusually talented group of people to campus. The rest is in the story. Louise, and you got a full, 4 years full freight from the Ford Foundation.
Yeah, yeah.
So Louise was one of the recipients of that. Nothing to do with me. I grew up in a little suburb of New York called Leoni, New Jersey, which is where I lived for quite some years. And I'd gone to this high school in Englewood, New Jersey, and one of my classmates, and he's probably in this picture, I think, but I can't tell because it's too small, was a guy named Francis Brooks Collins, whose family came from Wisconsin.
Collins.
C-O-L-L-I-N-G-E. But his father was a partner in Arthur Anderson in New York mm-hmm. by then. So Francis Brooks Collins, whose nickname is Cal Collins, and I were very close friends. And he was committed to go to the University of Wisconsin, which was very unusual. This was a country day school, I think, where everybody went to Ivy League school, so it was very unusual. Somebody who had very good grades, and a good boys' school, would go to some public university in what appeared to be outer fucking boondock lunatic. Who could possibly imagine such a thing?
Right.
And so, in my summer of my junior year, I and Cal and one other guy spent the entire summer in the family fishing cottage, which is in Red Cliff. You know where Red Cliff is? Well, Red Cliff is an Indian reservation outside of Bayfield. You know where it's Bayfield?
In Wisconsin.
Yeah, in Wisconsin. Okay. So I spent this summer in Wisconsin. When I was a junior in college, in high school, and that was before I was deciding where to go to college. And I thought, this is really great, and I love this place, and Wisconsin's great, and Cal was going, and I didn't know where I wanted to go, and I wasn't particularly, we were all rebels in this class, for some reason, this class of whatever it was, 1953, the Englewood School for Boys. This is a school who subsequently became a co-ed, mm-hmm. and whose most most famous graduate is Brooke Shields. So you can see, it wasn't a high point of intellectuality. not that she's a smart lady, I'm sure.
I understand what you mean.
So it sort of was, you know, like, oh, well, this sounds interesting. Wisconsin's interesting. It's a great place. I want to get away from the East. I want to get away from my family. It was a lot of personal things. My father was ill. My mother was preoccupied.
Yeah.
So I came out. So that's how I ended up here. I was probably one of the very few freshmen who owned a really fancy sports jacket. This explains how I got to be elected in my freshman year to be president of the Robin Hood's Merry Men.
The sports jacket.
I never could understand. I was up front for these real leftists. I didn't understand it. I was just a kid, right? I was, you know, how old was I? 18. And I don't know how this happened. Looking back, you know, why did I get to be president of this organization when I was a freshman? There was still a lot of graduate students and people like that. Well, I think partly because I looked respectable. And there were a lot of people who were, you know, very left-wing, and indeed Communist Party members in Wisconsin after the University of Wisconsin. So I guess, that probably explains a little bit of how this happened, although I must confess that I don't really know.
How did you even find your way to this group? I mean, even to one of their meetings? You can't remember. So you didn't have political ambitions when you came
here? No, I had some political interest and ambition. I had political interest and ambition, but they weren't very well formed. I certainly had no, I mean, you know, my most political thing I'd done was organize a rebellion against the dress code at the English School for Boys. That was the most radical thing that I had politically. And it was a very tumultuous year.
Mm-hmm.
First place, I had a lot of trouble adjusting to the university. The graduating class at the Englewood School for Boys had 15 students.
Mm-hmm.
So I come here when Wisconsin was a third of its current size, but was actually much less well organized and totally unorganized for out-of-state students. There was no housing for us. There was no there was advising, and this is an interesting story. But there was no housing arrangements. There was no one to sort of tell you what you should do. You had no advising as to what you ought to study. Once you selected a major, they would be arrangements for some advising, but you had no counseling on what you ought to do.
Yeah.
The Ford students, almost all of whom came from outside Wisconsin, although there were some Wisconsin students, but it was a large group of people that were recruited on a national basis.
Yeah.
And then assigned, I don't know how it worked, I don't know how you ended up, there were four schools, Chicago, Columbia, Yale, and Wisconsin, where you could go. And I don't know whether you chose, or whether you were just assigned, or how it worked.
I heard from another student that he chose Wisconsin, that he kind of preferenced. I know a little bit. You know, this was a guy who came in 51.
Okay, there's a guy. No, there was no Ford students. You mean the class of 51?
No, he would have come and graduated in 55.
Yeah, 55 was the first year. Now, there's a guy named John Israel, who's a historian, and was at Virginia. And he's coming out in May for the 55 reunion. In fact, this is an opportunity for you, because not just the Ford students, but people from that era are now beginning to come back to campus. And the first, you'll get the Israel I know is coming, John Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You can get his name at the University of Virginia History Department. And his website, that's where you can get his email and get the email contact. But I know he's coming because the reason for the question.
And he's another Ford student?
He was a Ford student. And he's a historian. He was very active on campus, so he'll know a lot. And he's a very good person to put. So it was a very tumultuous year for me personally, because I found it extremely difficult to adapt to this unbelievable place. In those days, the way you did registration, the old Red Gym, you know about this? You heard this story?
I've heard a little bit.
It was this insane thing where they had, you ran around and you picked up little IBM cards for the courses you want, and then you put it in. someplace, and then they grant it, and then
it's chaos.
I couldn't believe it. The four students were channeled into something called integrated liberal studies, which is a very important part of the University of Patona, and something that you probably want to learn about. It's mentioned in the Wisconsin article. So they had a kind of home, and integrated liberal studies at that time was really a college within a college. It was kind of the last incarnation of the Michael John idea. And it really was, everybody took the same courses, and they only took those courses. So for 2 years, you were in this sort of highly selective group of people, and with all sorts of support services and stuff. I mean, relative to the rest of you,
right,
being thrown in as a freshman in this, you know, dedicated thing. But I had decided I wanted to be a pre-med major, which was a terrible mistake. I faint at the sight of blood, and I'm bad at science. I had to learn that. I learned that. That
took
year.
A while. Huh?
They took me. They used to keep the cadavers in the top floor of science hall. I remember going up there and saying, "I don't have any part of this." Then I flunked chemistry. That was a great move. Plus, and this is part of this. This is how I ended up as the editor of the Octopus. Plus, okay. So we're having this political turmoil, this Joe Musco thing. I get elected president for reasons that I can't really understand. Meanwhile, I'm living in this horrible rooming house on Langdon Street, hating it, trying to find a way in life. I had had some contact with Quakers, although my upbringing had nothing to do with Quakers. I'm half Jewish, half... My father was lapsed Jewish and my mother was lapsed Catholic, if you can believe such a thing. And I grew up in an atmosphere that was saturated with Protestantism because of where I lived and the schools I went to, and even attended Protestant Sunday schools for a while. So I had this total, you know, confused religious or non-religious identity. And I, for some reason, started going to Quaker meetings. And I met this guy at the Quaker meetings who was actually a window salesman. And this story may seem complicated, but it all comes together. Okay, so this guy was trying to find people to live in a house that he wanted to rent in Shorewood at 1002 Oak Way, which is a house designed by a recent Frank Lloyd Wright student, a recent graduate of Taliesin, and which, for complicated reasons, not the least of which was that it was freezing cold inside in the winter, was very hard to break. And he was looking for people. So I ended up with the window salesman, a shoe salesman, a sophomore in mathematics major, who's now a math professor at NYU, a graduate student in physics, who was about to finish his doctorate in nuclear physics, a graduate student in physical chemistry, senior in meteorology and a senior in journalism and naval science. They weren't all there. It was kind of a floating group. People came in there during the year. In this house in the middle of this upper middle class suburb. So, all this year, Joe Must Go is going on. And we're trying to get the petition. So you understand what Robin Hood's Merryman was set up to be the campus arm of the statewide Joe Must Go movement.
And this is, what year did you actually come here? Fall of 52 or fall of 53?
Fall of 53. That's 53, 54.
Okay.
53, 54.
This is a recall movement.
Which was a recall movement. Okay. And so Robin Hood Merryman was, in fact, the campus, and where that name came from, I have no idea.
Well, I think there were some efforts by McCarthy supporters to ban Robin Hood as a communist-inspired story.
Is that right? Okay.
I don't think it was in Wisconsin. I think it was somewhere else.
I don't know. But anyway, yeah. So I'm sort of going through these three experiences. This housing experience, which is living in this strange world, in this place where we were sort of connected, we were sort of the periphery of a left countercultural group that was centered in the Gross Co-op and the Green Lantern, mm-hmm. which is where actually Louise was, because she was in Gross Co-op and the Green Lantern. But she was in the Green Lantern, not living in Gross Co-op, living nearby. Actually living down the street from Louise, she was somewhere. And so I had the academic crisis in my life. I had this political world, turmoil of this political world, the Joe Must Go movement, and then this whole social housing world. Okay, well, the social housing world came to a crisis when the graduate student, there's a story about life in 1950, the graduate student, guys just, almost finished his education, nuclear physics, starts having an affair with an undergraduate woman who lived in some sort of, supervised housing circuit, because all undergraduate women had to be supervised. Yeah. And she would spend the night on the couch in our house, in Florida, which we weren't too thrilled about.
Yeah.
Stephanie Posen, I remember her well. Well, it turns out that Stephanie Posner. Oh, and we had a cocktail party. This guy also gave a cocktail party for the faculty of the physics department.
At
this place. It's a beautiful, modern, Frank Lloyd Wright type house in Shorewood, but it was so badly designed that it was freezing in the winter. Subsequently, it had 2,500 square feet of single pane plate glass and a totally inefficient heating system.
Was it built for Arizona or whatever?
No, it was just built by this guy. It was his first building out of school. He just didn't have the kind of technical skills, and he didn't have the money. He paid for it himself. He lived in it while he built it, and then he put it on the market. Subsequently, the people put in better heating units. They did put in, they replaced it with double pane glass, and I visited there once when I came back years ago. It's really nice place. But I want to get to the story because it has to do with the octopus. So, but in part because of the Stevie, anyway, she got caught because she pretended she was going to visit somebody and she didn't go there, and then she got a telephone call. The campus authorities found out about the cocktail party, which was illegal because you couldn't have a cocktail party. Students couldn't have a cocktail party unless it was registered with the campus officials. Female students couldn't leave their registered places unless they went to a place that had already been approved. Anyway, we all got in trouble, and we were called into the Dean of Students and threatened with expulsion. They did expel the graduate student and Steve. And I guess, I don't know, he came back later and finished his doctorate, but at least they were suspended for a year. We were given warnings for having cocktail parties without a license because we were not guilty of any of the other charges.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all of this was managed by the Dean of Students, who was a guy named Theodore Zillman. I'm sure you've come across that name. Who also was the faculty advisor of the octopus.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
And so because I got to know Zillman in the course of this, and I had been very active in high school in magazines and newspapers and yearbooks and all this crap in this little tiny place where you could be the editor of everything. And me and Cal Collins, we ended up, he offered us to be the editorship of the humor magazine because the guy was supposed to be the editor had gotten drafted. Now that's a story, right? So end up, in my sophomore year, editor-in-chief of this humor magazine, which I then turned over to another guy from the Cliff House, that was the name of the house, the Cliff House, his name is Harold M. Edwards, who now is a professor of mathematics and a very well, very distinguished mathematician, but he did study the humor magazine. So that's a story of the octopus.
Yeah.
And that's a story of, complicated, confused housing, counterculture worlds. We had all sorts of fascinating people, one of whom is still here. That's Jim Jones. who is a professor emeritus in a law school, who was a student here. He was a law student at that time. This is a guy who served in the Second World War. I mean, Jim Jones is in his 80s. He's around. I see him in the law school at the time. Black, grew up in Little Rock. Was in the segregated armed forces in the Second World War. Leading figure in the history of employment discrimination law. Worked for the Department of Labor. Was very much involved in the creation of affirmative action programs in employment and stuff like that. He was involved in this work. And it's a guy who's going to have to be out of the kingdom and he was probably left to make plays, but he's been like an ancient guy. And it was all connected. So there was this connected world of Groves Co-op, which was a sort of left-leaning women's residence. Mm-hmm. In the basement was the Green Lantern, which attracted a lot of these sort of, cosmopolitan, left-leaning people from all over campus. Us out in Shorewood in the Cliff House, having links to people who were there. We were having all the social life. It was connected to this sort of, loosely defined left-leaning political world. And meanwhile, I'm doing all these rather conventional things, like being an editor of a humor magazine. But all of this came together when we did the ROTC issue of the Human Rights. So in the second year, in the first year, we probably was very much, in the second year, we decided to do a special issue to mock the ROTC. I have it upstairs.
I looked through some of those old octopuses, but I didn't, I don't know, but I looked at every issue, maybe I missed this one.
Well, I don't have time to go.
I'll take a look for it.
I know it's there somewhere, upstairs on the third floor. But this is very important because all the rest of them were. Well, no, we did get in trouble. We did get in trouble for running a dirty joke. But the ROTC issue, I think, actually was the real reason that they tried to crack down on it. So we published this issue on it. So very cleverly, and a graphic artist who was really clever, James. And it was just mocking our teacher. And in order to publicize it, we set up a pub tent between the Memorial Library and the main library, mm-hmm. where there is now a fountain. This was before mm-hmm. there was a fountain there, which is an empty space. And we put a pub tent and some signs. It was an advertising room. And a bunch of ROTC students came from the Red Gym, which is where ROTC trained. And ripped down all the stuff, ripped it up, attacked us.
Really?
No, this really happened. Hmm. So that's my second year. So what happened in the third year? I can't remember.
Now, when you were in this Robin Hood's Merry Men group, what kind of things were you doing?
Well, mostly we were getting people to sign the petition.
Okay.
That was what it was really about. So, because there were a lot of students who there were enough students around who could have voted you had to have voted in the last statewide election.
To be eligible.
In order to be eligible to sign the recall petition, you had to have voted in the last statewide election.
Okay.
So, the main thing was that, and trying to, which meant we were reaching a relatively small group of the student population, because we had to be able to vote, and I don't remember what the voting age was there, but I think it was 21 at that time. So anyway, that was the main thing. And what else went on, I don't know. I remember some meetings, but I can't really remember.
Do you remember what kind of reaction your group got from the campus or the broader community in Madison? Were you tolerated, or?
I can only tell you this story. One of the things we did was we hired somebody was organizing this. And here I was, theoretically, present, but there were some guys. Who they were, I don't remember. He must have really been mad that they were doing that. How did we end up with a car with a mobile loudspeaker? But we did.
Mm-hmm.
So I was assigned, or somehow got to be in charge of doing this, and we drove around. And I was with a young woman named Andrea Cloak, whose father was a professor at Lawrence, who's grown up in Lawrence, the academic friend. So Andrea Cloak and myself were driving a car. And she was driving, and I was talking on the loudspeaker saying, well, if you want to recall Senator McCarthy, go to the union, which is where we had the petitions, the signed petitions, and blah, 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 blah. Fight against this, whatever we can. And I remember we were driving on University Avenue and made a right turn again from, what's the name of the chemistry, not the chemistry, it was the physics building.
Sterling Hall?
Sterling Hall. Made a right turn to go up the hill. And somebody yelled at us, go back to New York! Because I had a decent accent. It'll do, but it was a lot stronger than. And I said to Andrea, I said, Andrea, I drive, you talk.
she was from here.
She was a Wisconsin girl. Mm-hmm. So there was some hostility. And this ROTC thing, although it wasn't related directly, you know, was the same kind of thing. Was there hostility to left-wing political activism on campus? Absolutely. Can I point to any particular thing? I can't think of anything that I haven't mentioned. As far as the community is concerned, by the time you get the membership list, this is all coming from outside the campus. Mm-hmm. But that's the community. Although it was focused on the Labor Youth League, it was actually, I think, generated by a general feeling that the campus was full of that community coming from the community. It was. So they went crazy.
And what about this New York Association? So you were from New York and New Jersey. And there was certainly the belief amongst a lot of people that these were the problem students. These were the ones that were bringing this radicalism to campus.
Yes.
And you kind of straddled this in a way because you, I don't know.
It wasn't that radical.
You weren't. Or it wasn't.
Oh. Well, that was the thing, you see. I wasn't, you know, I didn't fit the radical profile. Although I came from New Jersey, but had a lot of money. My family was quite affluent. I did sort of things like edit Beaver magazine. I was at ROTC. Served as an officer of the military police. So I wasn't quite out of that world. My politics were liberal democratic, not in any way on the sort of real left. But I was interested in those things and. The people with, and I was interested in history and intellectual history, and so that I found that the people who I was intellectually interested in turned out often to have extremely left-wing politics in the courseware. And there was this kind of never semi-underground, which we'll get to because the membership list was sort of about this never left-wing underground. It wasn't literally an underground. There were people who didn't stand up and say, I'm a communist. And that was indeed what the membership of the Youth Fight was about, was whether you could force people to do that at that point in time. It's like a big deal. You know, we're at the twilight of the McCarthy era, but still, I can't remember when McCarthy was in the century. Do you know the date?
54.
So you see, it's just coming to an end, but it's still it's alive. It's alive in the country and with you know it. So there was this world. Was it made up exclusively or primarily people from New York and New Jersey? Actually, no. But were there a lot of people, there were a lot of, don't forget there were a lot of, authentic Midwest radicals,
mm-hmm.
Like Andy Cloak and her brother Ted, and all the people from Chicago. I had a girlfriend there at some point who was, father was a union organizer in Chicago, and she was a real left-wing activist. So the answer is yes, there were people from New York, and because Wisconsin was considered to be a very, very important and prestigious place among certain communities. I mean, Louise grew up in Brooklyn. Her father was a very poor family, and she was a letter. He was a letter carrier for a while, and he became a high school teacher. But in that community, but he big cluster of itself, and I thought that was true in a lot of these communities.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a very good reputation, and so if you look at, you know, what would be interesting would be to just see what percentage of all out-of-state students were from those, from the East and from those places. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's very high. So that it wasn't, you know, that the conservative students as well as left-wing students came because the East, you know, so, and were the out-of-state students, you know, now, the point was that there were some out-of-state students who came here for the purpose of maintaining left-wing politics, and that's the great story about the way you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they came. But we'll get to that. So, yes. But I was kind of, you know, unusual because I wasn't really involved. I didn't come from any tradition that had you know, as long a tradition of really hard left politics as a lot of people did. I didn't, both from the Midwest and from, you know, whether it was the Progressive Party,
right.
And, you know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of Midwest populist radicalism as well. And
yep.
So it all sort of met in the 50s here. But I also, you know, at least reminded me that, that we took quite a few classes together toward the end of the senior year. She said, I remember you coming to talk about class in your ROTC uniform, and you always showed up late because you were some thrill.
So you did 4 years of ROTC?
I did 4 years of ROTC, and then when they arrived in the Army with the commission.
Okay, so you had the option of leaving ROTC, but you decided to wasn't there 2 years of basic, and then you
had to do 2 years. Everybody had to do 2 years,
right.
Unless you tried to become a conscientious objector, then it's almost impossible.
Right.
And then you could choose to stay or not, and I decided to stay.
And why did you decide to stay?
Well, because I thought being an Army officer would be a cool thing.
So you were military life seemed attractive in some ways.
Well, I wasn't planning to make a career of it,
right.
But it seemed like an attractive thing. And of course, also in those days, you had a very good chance if you were a commissioned of going to Europe. And so I thought, oh, okay. But that didn't work out. Well, at that point, you could, there were two options that you could take if you went to the other commission. You could apply to go in for 2 years and then serve 4 years in the military,
mm-hmm.
or 6 months and then 7.5 years in the military,
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
Yeah.
And so you expressed a preference, but then they did what they could do. And so but of course, if you put in 6 months, you'd never get another piece of post.
Too short.
So I put in 2 years. They gave me 6 months. Now, this may be related to the next point, where ROTC means student politics. So we're segueing along. So in my junior year, I won the award for the outstanding junior on campus, which was given out, or was it my senior year? I can't remember. One of those years. Given out by the same dean of students. The Somebody Something Award. And I was a member of Iron Cross. You know, from Iron Cross?
You know, the military organization?
No. You don't know nothing.
No?
No, this was the elite male honor society.
Oh, okay.
Called Iron Cross. Can you believe this? I don't know if it still exists. But maybe they've changed it to, you know, daffodils.
Yellow daffodils.
The yellow daffodils. I mean, I can't believe it really worked for all these years and it kept the same. Or that really we never gave it a moment's thought. No, this was the organization that, let's see if it's still, if it's still on the campus.
Sure.
This was an organization that was sort of an honor society. It wasn't grades. It wasn't like Phi Beta Kappa. But you had to be, you had to have good grades, but it was student BMOC, right? And there was a female.
A corollary to that?
Yeah, which Louise was in, but what the hell the name of it is, I can't remember. I know it's, yes, here it is. The Iron Cross Society, here it is. It
still exists, huh?
There it is. But I see they have integrated it. Students and teams and group camps in their past leadership and service.
That's what that meant?
It must have been.
Interesting.
What do you think of that? So, Iron Cross. You know who was in Iron Cross? Somebody I'm sure who was in my class and was in Iron Cross was Stephen Ambrose. That's
bastard.
He was a big football player.
Right.
You see. But he was an intellectual football player. So, you see, you couldn't get into Iron Cross just because you were a football player. But if you're a football player with top grades, you know, they knew make it. So this is, you understand, this is, I've got this totally complicated profile. Well, half of me is over there with the, what Max Shulman called the Subversive Elements League. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Max Shulman was a humorist of this period, and he has a wonderful article somewhere about about student politics at Minnesota and Wisconsin. I think he writes mostly about Minnesota. In this story, a group of students from the Minnesota campus organization called the SEL, the Subversive Elements League, led by that fiery Jewish firebrand Yehuda Samovar, comes down to the union and gets into a fight with fraternity boys in front of the union. This was referred to subsequently by SEL members as the Battle of the Steps. So anyway, so I'm here, you know, hanging out with Yehuda Samovar on one hand,
yeah,
and Steve Ambrose and the ROTC and Arthur Hubby. There's another person who's around town.
I've talked to him.
Who, see, Arthur Hubby was the commanding officer of my MP battalion. See, Kyle.
So, he told me he was a man.
Huh?
He told me he was
a man. Yeah, well, that's how I know Arthur Hubby. Was from the MPs. We're big buddies. So I'm sort of living in these completely different worlds. All those years. Okay, so this comes together in the following situation. So when I was... So I was editor of the Octopus. Then I helped start a literary magazine called The New Idea, which was ended up being part of The Daily Cardinal. Okay. And I wrote a column for The Daily Cardinal. And Dick Schickel, you know from Dick Schickel?
Mm-hmm.
So Dick Schickel was the campus correspondent of Milwaukee Journal, and this was a big honor, and it was passed on.
Oh, okay.
From person to person. So he selected me to take that over. That was in my senior year. That was a tremendous honor. Much more important than a lot of the other things, because this was recognition by your peers that you were the top journalist of the year. And it was an interesting job. I made a little money, and I learned to write quickly under pressure and stuff like that. So the Labor Youth League was... organized a folk song concert with Pete Seeger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I covered it for the Milwaukee Journal. Because I wanted to go anyway, but I was going to write a story about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's it. And I took Gary Samovar or whatever his name was to this concert.
Now, you weren't a member of the Labor Youth.
No.
But you were aware from your work in politics and MacArthur and the MacArthur groups of their existence. And
oh yeah, you knew who they were, right? And I'll tell you. But yeah, I knew. I don't think that I could say that I actually ever spoken to the there were three names come to mind: Henry Wirtis, Brian Radot, and R.D. Lieber.
Mm-hmm. I've talked to Henry Wirtis.
Okay,
he was the found fourth scholar that I was mentioning.
Ah, okay. Now, well, what about Brian Radosh, who's become a right-wing historian?
Right.
Have you talked to him?
I haven't talked to him yet.
Okay.
One of these things.
Well, okay. So, I can't remember exactly how this worked. Maybe you know. Was Lieber the head of it? Well, anyway, Wirtis and Radosh were the two known names. They were the head, the president, the vice president, something like that, right? Of the Labor Youth. Is that right?
It's a at one point or another. It sounds like they kind of switched on and off, but the other way.
Okay. But this all has to do with what was really at stake in the membership thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Now. Now I'm getting this. I'm losing exactly. Where is graduated in 55? Mm-hmm. Okay, so Wordis was gone by the time we got to the membership.
I think it was Radosh and a guy named Matt Chaperon, who were the two public members in 56 or
Matt,
so.
Matt. And Matt was a music student, right?
I don't know.
No, but this is important.
Okay.
Because where did they come from? See, this is the question. Because Wordis, okay, so he was a Ford student, so he came here because of Ford student. But then when Wordis and Lieber, I think it was Wordis and Lieber left, and then these two other guys showed up, Radosh and this guy Matt. And Matt was a music student who was, I think, at Oberlin or someplace, I mean, a serious music place. You have to look into this.
Okay.
Because why did he come to Wisconsin? It made no sense, except that the party needed somebody to keep the Labor Youth League alive, and they had to have two people who would be willing to stand up and say they were officers. This was what everybody suspected, and probably was the case.
Yeah.
That is, they moved and suddenly took over this thing when Williams left.
Yeah.
Did I know Henry Williams? No, I don't think I ever actually spoke to him. I'm sure we were at some meetings, I heard him talk, but I was not an intimate in any way. Another person from this period who was very important was Saul Landau.
I'm trying to get in touch with him.
He was a major figure in this left world of Wisconsin in that period. In the really hard left world. Now, another figure who was on the fringes of that world, but was an authentic native Wisconsin radical, was Bertha Holmes, who of course went on to be a well-known Marxist philosopher, a political philosopher in that year, and author of a game called Class Struggle, which was a... No, it's a big deal. It was supposed to be the Marxist equivalent of Monopoly. And he tried to make a lot of money on it. He tried to get me to invest in it once. I tried to total business. All right, so I'm trying to bring all this together because we're going to run out of time here. So here I am living in these two worlds. And here's how my two worlds, or my three worlds, the journalism world, the left politics world, and the ROTC world, and the wanting to be, more conventional political aspirations, perhaps, all came together, and that was over the loyalty oath. And I've been telling the story to a lot of people who find it hard to believe, because I've been trying to catch for people the atmosphere of the McCarthy period and what it was like. People say, oh my God, we're in this period of depression. I say, you don't know from depression. If you've never lived through the McCarthy period. So, here's the story. So I go to this thing. I write an article for the Lucky Journal, I'm sure. And then as I'm filling out the forms to apply for my commission, one of the things you had to sign was a loyalty oath.
For the Milwaukee Journal?
No, for my...
Oh, your military commission. Okay, gotcha.
You had a lot of paperwork to fill out, right? And one of them was you had to sign the standard loyalty oath that everybody was signing those days if you had to work in the United States government.
Yeah.
And one of the things that it said was, have you ever been a member of or attended a meeting organized by any of these 200 and some groups that were on the Attorney General's list? And guess what was there? So there you go. So, I thought, what do I do? I was there, and I was a journalist, but I'm not a member. I never had anything to do with it, except I knew it existed. But the campus is full spot. They probably have lists of people who attend. Everybody knows who I am. I was a student senator, I was a journalist, I was all of that. I better check. Yeah, I'll just explain it.
Holy shit. I get a call. You are required to report to the courthouse downtown to meet with people from military intelligence in Washington. Come on. Don't listen to me. This is too tough. They give me their credentials, their military intelligence. And they interrogated me for 5 hours about every possible person I'd ever met. I know all these radicals. Did you know any words? Did you know this? Did you know what about Ted Close? Ted Andrew Close, we know you know them. Oh my God. My father had on the way.
Yeah.
And it turned out that the executive director actually was a guy who had been in the Communist Party. I don't maybe know that, but yeah. But it came out. So they had that.
They was this your was this an FBI file that they had on you?
I don't know.
You know, something.
I don't know. But they didn't have that, but they were asking me questions about my father. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. Anything. My father has had some visible association with an organization that has been attacked by another one of these McCarthy organizations, something called Red Channels. You know about Red Channels? Red Channels was the this newsletter that was primarily aimed at outing leftists in the media and Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But they had somehow they ran an article about this organization my father made. He was a businessman. It was a part-time job. He's based in Washington. And they did a lot of work with Estes Kefauver, that notorious radical. So I thought, oh boy, what? This was really scary. I mean, I know that all my associations, all the people I've lived with over time. Well, I got the commission. Subsequently went on, had a job in the government, had a top secret clearance. You know. But each time that I would go for something like this, like a top secret clearance, there would be questions that people would be, there would be some. So obviously there's somewhere there's this file. Mm-hmm. On me, right? Somewhere in the great government archives. But so that's how it all came together, and how the being involved with the radicals, but being in the world of ROTC, student politics, and journalism, all sort of came together. And then the other place where it came together was my membership list, which we could talk about in more detail when if you want to come back and talk to Louise. I'd really enjoy that because I'd like to, Louise and I haven't really sat down and tried to reminisce about this. But the short story is, I don't know how it all started. I don't know exactly how we it all. You know, Louise will remember. She has a very good memory. But basically, we were all students at it. Me and Louise are our applicants, and other people. And I think it was the American Legion that initiated it. And the idea was, you know, we're not trying to stop free speech. We just want people to, we want information. But everybody knew that if you forced the Labor Youth League to reveal the 12 members that you had to certify. You know the details of this stuff, right?
No, not all the details.
All right. So here's, check this, because I could be wrong, but in my memory was that the university rules were you could be an official university organization, which meant you could, you get certain facilities.
Right.
And
yeah.
You didn't get much for it, but right. I don't think they had money. I don't think they gave out a lot of money the way they do now, but
yeah.
Maybe they did a little. But basically, you could hold a meeting on campus was about the big thing. And you had to, there had to be two names, a president, vice president, and then you had to certify that they were, either 10 more people or 12. Number 12 sticks in my mind. But they couldn't get, you couldn't get 12 people to send you the members of an organization on the Attorney General list, which means you couldn't get a government job. At that point, if you were a member, for instance, you could not get a government job either.
Yeah.
State.
Yeah.
Federal or state. Or university, in many public universities. Mm-hmm. Or at least it was a real problem.
Right.
Nobody's going to get
this. Oh, sure, sure.
So this turned into a big free speech. Right. Now, how we decided, how the student Santa got involved in this, how Louise and I and God Optimus decided we were going to fight a campaign, I can't remember. But it was a superbly successful campaign. Mm-hmm. We even got the Pan-Hellenic Council. Can you believe that?
Bastion of conservative.
The Pan-Hellenic Council signed the petition. And the group that made the decision was the Student Life and Interest Committee, or STIC. And they voted to reject the proposal. And I know, you know, we had meetings and speeches, and I wrote a bunch of columns about this, didn't I? I think you remember in the column.
I'll have to take another look.
I remember I wrote at least, I remember writing a long, long article, which was all about the, you know, the sifting winnowing plaque and who did that and how that all fit in and all that, which was part of that campaign. It may not have been directly related to it. And I remember going back and reading that big thick history of the university, and I learned a lot about the invention in the 90s.
What I remember of this time is that after the Pete Seeger concert, there was some problem with SLIC because the Youth League had not registered this event accordingly or something. And so the two leaders, Ron Yadosh and this other guy, Matt Chevron, got in trouble. And they were going to have two other people step forward. And this was part of the reason why they collapsed on campus or something of that sort.
Well, I know they collapsed on campus. This is a story I didn't know. Because I remember writing an article for the Milwaukee Journal toward the end of my senior year announcing that it was closing. After this whole successful fight, right?
I'll have to take a look back at my notes.
You see, we think that Matt Chaperone and Word and Radosh moved to, they came to Wisconsin the year before. They were not there from the beginning. That they were sent there by the party to keep it alive. That's something that would be great to find out.
Well, Radosh, I don't know if you've ever come across it. He wrote an autobiography a few years ago called Commies. he talks a little bit about this time. I can't remember the reason he gives for coming out here. I'm not sure.
Well,
not that he would even admit to, you know, who knows how much the truth is there and how much is kind of taking over some of those things.
Well, the one that really created the sense of suspicion was the other guy, because it didn't seem that if he were a music major, he'd move to Wisconsin. It certainly wasn't from wherever he was.
Yeah,
it was some. I could be wrong. I do remember that was something. So the answer was there was this world, there was this organization. The Labor Youth League was a front of the Communist Party. There was no question about it. That wouldn't have made a difference, I think, to us if we had known that. We certainly didn't know it at the time. It was a very small part of a very large kind of loose sort of left, politically active, intellectually active world. Not by any means there was SLID was another organization going on. That was only the branches. So all these things went on. And people like Louise and I were sort of, we were sort of floating among all of this, but we weren't either of us active in any of these really left organizations. So we were sort of the left wing of campus leadership rather than the leadership of campus leftism. But because we had only social ties and personal relationships, I used to eat a lot of food. Green room and coffee, but the food was atrocious, but the girls were great. Louise knows that something. She was one of them. So that's kind of, you know, those are very just general reminiscences, but it was a very exciting time.
Yeah.
It was a great informal education, to use some of the college phrase. I thought, Sonny, we were talking last night, we had a dinner party for a woman from England, and she was a visitor, and we were talking about American undergraduate education and British undergraduate education. And I said, you know, we had a great education.
of the Yale Law School. So most of the people at the Yale Law School were from Ivy League schools and prep schools and the whole nine yards. And they said, well, you know, because they had a lot of advantages, but we had a lot of experiences, and both intellectually and sort of socially and politically, but they didn't have any somewhat constrained, narrow, you know, environments. I mean, and also there was a looseness to the academic side, which there was a relationship to the academic side, so that you could, if you were really aggressive, you could really get interested in education, even though it wasn't packaged for you.
What did your major end up being?
Well, I majored in history, but the three courses that I think, I'm thinking of the courses that really had the greatest influence, I took a course on Yeats, which was fantastic. I was a French minor, and that made a big difference, because you know, to use Romance language, mostly Spanish and Portuguese in my career when I'm doing the state department. So there was a friend, there were courses in French literature, there was Yeats course. I talked my way into a graduate seminar in sociology on Calcutta Parsons, which was a great experience. There was a great course taught by a law professor for undergraduates on sort of law and society, legal process, so, which was a very, very influential course, the reason I both took that. And in a way, it was better than courses I had at Yale also. I mean, it was as good as any course I had at Yale. And then I took a lot of history courses, of which the one I remember the most was Ludwig Hesseltine, who was this crazy guy. Steve Ambrose was his great protege. But he was an incredible showman. So it was great. And then, of course, I learned map review in ROTC. So, now, you know, I think you probably want to have some more specific questions.
Yeah, well, let's, I would look
let's
forward to
let's take a short
meeting.
Time. Maybe you want to identify some specific questions so we could set this set up another meeting. We can't set it up now because I didn't get the release schedule. Okay. But what? Where are you on this? Are you in the very early days?
No. I've done quite a bit of research. I've written a couple of chapters. I'm just about to sit down in a couple of weeks and start working on the third chapter, of maybe six or something along those lines. So I'm moving along. It is slow going. I have a lot of non-school responsibilities. I got a few kids, but. Take up quite a bit of my time.
And how did you, since you asked me how I came to Wisconsin, I have to ask you, how did you get into this topic? And who do you work with? And is this seen as American cultural history? Or
American social history, maybe. I mean, those boundaries are kind of a little vague, ambiguous these days. Good question. How I actually got into this topic. I have to think about that. I was in a research seminar, and for whatever reason I chose this topic, just for a seminar, a paper, and then it evolved into my master's thesis, and then has, you know, evolved into this.
How long have you been at Wisconsin?
I've been here for 6-7 years. This is, I guess, my seventh year.
And where did you do your undergraduate?
I did my undergraduate at a little school, Whitman College. I'm from Seattle, Washington. Whitman is in a little town called Walla Walla, Washington.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, I came out here. I took a few years, my wife and I took a few years off after we finished undergrad. And then I'd never been to Wisconsin before. I applied, got accepted, picked up the U-Haul and drove on out here, 2000 miles.
And who's your major advisor?
A guy named